Hello, and welcome to lies.com podcast number, gosh, I can't remember. I think number 8. This is Thursday, December 22nd, 2005. And as you no doubt can tell from the background noise, I am once again recording this while on my Uber commute into work. One of the things that I sort of anticipated when I started this job and knew that I was going to be having an hour and a half commute each way on top of an 8-hour, well, 9-hour if I take an hour for lunch, workday, was that other things in my life were going to have to be de-emphasized. And at the top of the list of things that I was going to have to cut back on was all the time I spend on lies.com, which, if you follow the site, you know isn't something I spend hours and hours on every day. Occasionally I'll spend an hour or two when some new obsession has me firmly in its grasp, but, you know, at least, 15, 20 minutes, half an hour a day, probably on average, is what I was putting into it while working at home as a consultant. And really, I just don't have the time for that right now. Maybe I can find a way to fit it into my schedule. And podcasting is not, to my mind at least, a completely adequate replacement for web blogging in terms of the kind of information I'd like to get out there, but I don't know. Web blogging in general and podcasting in particular, if you want to view podcasting as a subset of web blogging, they're both pretty much vanity pursuits anyway. And so, you know, if there's someone out there who actually is interested in my thoughts on the things I talk about in these podcasts or that I write about on lies.com, then I'm happy that they're out there reading it. But really, it's more the belief on my part, it's the mythical sense I have that there's an audience out there just hanging on my next word that provides a good chunk of the motivation for me to actually do it. So I think it doesn't really matter much if anybody's actually listening. So if my potential audience is reduced somewhat or even reduced a lot by doing this in podcast form, I think that's a price I'm willing to pay, and it's making a virtue of necessity since I just don't have the time to do all that web blogging. But I have an abundance of time in which I can do podcasting, as it turns out, as long as you're willing to put up with the sort of quality issues, audio quality issues that are the result of my combination of cheap recording hardware and a fairly noisy recording studio. Anyway, one thing I've promised myself more than once in thinking about podcasting or thinking about the things I want to podcast is that I will not devolve into what I'm actually doing right now, which is just sort of solipsistic masturbatory, self-referential rambling. I'm not quite to the point of that Dave Weiner podcast that I made fun of in an earlier podcast, where he simply hums and grunts and, you know, says literally nothing of value for minutes at a time. But I'll try and move on to something of at least some degree of interest. Where I started with all this was talking about how podcasting is... writing on lies.com is something I don't have time for, and I knew I wouldn't have time for it with the new job, but it still, on an emotional level, has more impact than I anticipated. It's one of those things that you can see coming, you know, you can imagine it coming, and then when it actually reaches you, it's still different than what you expected. Your attempt to prepare yourself mentally by previewing in your mind what it was going to be like really was not adequate preparation for the reality. That reminds me of another story. And since there's not much point to these podcasts other than sort of randomly diverging into stories that may or may not be interesting, I'll diverge into this story. I talked in an earlier podcast about sailboat racing and how I grew up doing a lot of offshore racing on my father's sailboats and learned how to get up in the middle of the night, or struggled with the need to get up in the middle of the night in order to stand a night watch. And another story that what I was just talking about reminds me of is a little bit later in my sailing career, when I was, I guess, a teenager, maybe 15 years old or so, and was racing on my father's Columbia 52 Victoria, which we did a lot of offshore racing and buoy racing in and around Southern California on. And there was one year we were doing the, I think technically it was the LA Times series. It was the PHRF rating systems component of the Whitney series, which is a series of buoy races that happen in the, like, January or February, I want to say, early spring, late winter, early spring, which is the time when it's windiest in Southern California, so it tends to be when the most serious racing takes place. In this race, it was a series of buoy races. It was, I think, two races on Saturday and a race on Sunday around L.A. Harbor. And I guess the previous week, in a race I hadn't gone on, my father had had one of these infamous starting line interactions that he had from time to time, where he wanted a spot on the starting line and another boat was barging, that is, coming towards him from a windward position, basically trying to steal the right of way from him. It's like if two cars approach a four-way intersection and you get there a little bit ahead of the other guy, so technically you have the right of way, but before you can enter the intersection, he hits the gas and zooms out in front of you, sort of taking the right of way when he didn't have the right to it. That's sort of what barging on the starting line is like in a sailboat race. You've got a boat to windward that is not entitled to room, and you've got your space. You're approaching the starting line in the last few seconds before the starting gun goes off, and that's your spot. And you've got a boat from a windward position coming down on you, basically encroaching on your space. And they don't have the right to that space, and you do have the right to that space. So it, you know, turns into a yelling match on the starting line. You've got the boat down to leeward saying, you know, come up, you're barging, and, you know, the boat to windward may or may not respond to your yelling. And eventually, if you know, both skippers are sufficiently adamant about what they're trying to do, it'll actually come to the point of a near collision. Now, technically, under the racing rules, even if you have the right-of-way, you can still be kicked out of a race. You can still be disqualified from a race or assess, you know, some sort of penalty if a collision occurs and it's determined that you did not do everything in your power to avoid it, which is a, you know, good rule when you think about it. So, you know, what you're officially supposed to do in a situation where a boat is barging on you and not responding to your hails is you're supposed to get out of the way at the last second and then protest them. You know, you pop your little red protest flag, and after the race you go to a committee hearing and you basically have a little mini trial where you lay out your case and they lay out their case and the race committee decides who is in the right. And if you're found in the wrong, you're disqualified from the race. At least this is the way it was back in the 1970s when I was doing this racing in local club racing in Southern California. Now they have on-the-water judges in a lot of cases, at least in high-profile racing, and they have on-the-water penalties like doing a 720-degree turn and continuing on the race course. Anyway, I'll try not to diverge from the divergence here. Anyway, the week before this particular race that I'm going to eventually tell you about, my father had apparently been in this barging situation, and, you know, he's more than once said to me in a sort of joking manner, well, you know, when you get to that committee hearing, that protest hearing after the race, if there wasn't actually a collision, it really comes down to his word against yours, whether there was an infraction, you know, because the barging boat can always claim that he actually gave you room, that, you know, no collision occurred because at the last minute he altered course and gave you just enough room for you to continue on your course without having to turn aside. And my dad, again, jokingly has said to me more than once that, well, if you can just tap him, if there can be just some sort of incidental contact, you know, not enough to actually do any damage or risk injuring anybody, but just enough that you can go into the protest hearing and say, hey, you know, contact occurred, because if contact occurred, then the race committee is basically required to find somebody at fault. It's not possible for them at that point to say that, oh, actually no foul occurred. If two boats hit each other, by definition, a foul did occur. So, you know, the fact that he said it jokingly, I find a little bit suspect, given that he's said it jokingly more than once. I think if you repeat a joke like that in a joking way more than once or twice, you've basically entered the realm of actually saying it. You know, you're revealing your true nature. In any event, my father more than once has had situations on the starting line that have resulted in a collision, where he, as far as I know, has always or almost always been found to be in the right. Typically, in those cases, I think the other boat is just retired from the race rather than going through the hassle of appearing in a protest hearing. But anyway, in this particular case, he had a barging situation. I think it may have been actually two different boats that were barging. And there was a collision. And despite his best efforts to have it be just a gentle little love tap, and actually, I give him the benefit of the doubt, despite his efforts to avoid the collision, strenuous efforts to avoid the collision that did in fact occur did significant damage to the front of the boat. Not the hull, but the bow pulpit, this sort of metal railing that encloses the bow of the boat. So all this is a preface to the information that in these races that I then went on, because I was not in the earlier race with this collision, there was no bow pulpit on the boat. He had removed it to have it repaired. And again, technically, this was a violation of the racing rules for him to even be on the race course without the bow pulpit, which is, in the racing we were doing, is a required piece of safety equipment. But my father has really never let that sort of thing get in the way of his participating in a good sporting competition. So we were out on the race course. We had no bow pulpit. The lifelines, that is the little wires that run along the side of the boat to kind of keep you to keep you on board, you know, things you hold on to keep from being keep from falling over the side of the boat, which normally terminate at the bow pulpit, you know, they're connected to it, were actually carried down to the deck and kind of lashed off on some cleats there. So the bow area was really free. And I was the bowman on the boat for this race. I was the person on the foredeck who was actually standing on the bow during sail changing maneuvers. And it made it kind of interesting. It was sort of like, I mean, in the America's Cup racing that I, even then, I think, seen some of on TV, they didn't have bow pulpits and lifelines on those boats because they were added windage and their racing rules didn't require them. So, you know, a bowman on an America's Cup boat was pretty much like a trapeze artist without a net up there. You know, you're dancing around on this skinny little point at the front end of the boat. You're grabbing sails, you're grabbing spinnaker poles, you're moving things around, and you've, you know, got to make sure you don't fall overboard, which is fun. So anyway, we were in this race, and I'll get to the actual point, which was, again, how your anticipation of an event isn't always sufficient to prepare you for the actual event. We were approaching the leeward mark with the spinnaker up, and it was pretty windy, and the call came to douse the spinnaker, which, you know, you do at the last possible moment, since you don't want to take it down early and lose distance to your competitors. So the spinnaker, which is this big, giant, sort of parachute-type sail that sits out in front of the boat, needs to be taken down. So we've raised the new headsail. That's the genoa, or jib, you're going to use for going back upwind after you turn around the leeward mark. We've raised the headsail, and it's hanging there ready to go. Now what needs to happen for this maneuver is the pole end of the spinnaker, the end of the spinnaker that's attached to this big, you know, in Victoria, which is a 52-foot boat, the spinnaker pole that it's attached to is like a 20-foot aluminum tube weighing, I don't know, maybe 20 pounds or so. The person on the bow needed to pop this this release pin on a shackle holding the pole to the corner of the spinnaker. So you needed to basically pop one corner of the spinnaker free so it could stream out like a flag, and you can then lower it. And this all has to happen fairly quickly, and there's a lot of coordination between the front of the boat, where, you know, I'm popping this shackle, and the back of the boat, where the people actually control the various lines, the after guy and the spinnaker sheet, that control the position of the thing that I'm supposed to be reaching and popping. So we're approaching the mark, and you know, it's time to pop that shackle, and I can't quite reach it. So I'm you know, normally I could kind of stand on the pulpit and get myself a few feet higher, and with one hand on the headstay to maintain balance, I could reach up higher and pop that pin. But with no pulpit to stand on, I really need that pole to be lowered to my position. So I'm shouting at the person at the back of the boat who controls the topping lift. You know, they got a name for everything on a boat. The line that actually would serve to lower the pole. I'm shouting at this person to give slack on the topping lift. But it's a 52-foot boat, and it's a windy day, and it's hard to make yourself heard, you know, from 40 or 50 feet away on a windy day on a boat that's traveling fast through the water. And then I realized that what's happened is the person on the topping lift has eased the topping lift, but in fact they've eased it too far. The force of the wind in the sail is what's actually holding the pole up at this point, and the topping lift has a bunch of slack in it. It's basically hanging in a, you know, an arc leading from the top of the pole to the mast. And you know, we managed, I think the person on the fore guy, which is the line coming down off the pole, manages to crank the pole down to where I can reach the shackle anyway. But now I'm looking at it and realizing that, you know, I've got one hand on the headstay so I don't lose my balance and fall overboard. I'm going to be reaching up with my second hand to pop the pin on this shackle to release the sail. But I realize that once I've done that, the slack in the topping lift is going to be really problematic because this 20-pound, you know, 25-foot-long aluminum pole, which is attached at the aft end to the mast, at the front end, is going to be free when I pop this shackle. It's going to just be, you know, hanging in the air. It's going to descend and hit me. And normally the topping lift, which is attached to the pole, would stop that, but because the person on the topping lift has eased it out too far in the effort to get the pole down to where I can reach it, there's slack in the topping lift, so it will not be caught by it. So basically I'm sitting there and I'm anticipating that, you know, when I pop this pin, this pole is going to drop like a guillotine and bonk me right on the head. And I thought about this for a second, and, you know, I was shouting at the back end of the boat, you know, take up the slack in the topping lift, there's take up the top, you know, taking the slack in the topping lift, I'm shouting at the top of my lungs, and it's not happening. And really, there were, as I saw it at the time, there are relatively few options. If we didn't get that pole, if I didn't pop that shackle, and you know, for us to start taking the spinnaker down, we were going to not get the spinnaker down in time. We were going to sail past that leeward mark. We were going to be losing lots and lots of distance to our competitors. And so I decided, with the bravado that's probably typical of 15-year-olds in a stressful situation like that, that, well, it might hurt, and it probably would hurt somewhat for the pole to hit me on the head. But, you know, pain's no big deal. I could handle it. I'd keep a tight grip on the headstay. I'd pop the pin, the pole would hit me, and no big deal. You know, no guts, no glory. We'd go on. So I went ahead. And I popped the pin. I reached up and I pulled the little plunger, the little lanyard attached to the pin on the shackle. And a bunch of things happened at once. But the main thing, for the purpose of my current discussion, that happened at that point was that I found out that, you know, anticipating something and deciding that you're ready for it is not the same thing as actually having experienced it and knowing firsthand what it's going to be like. And what I hadn't anticipated is that when that pole hit me, it didn't actually hurt. What it did is caused me to become unconscious. It knocked me out temporarily. And so there went my plan of hanging on to the headstay. So the next thing I knew was I kind of, you know, came to, and it was a very confusing scene that I saw, because what I saw was that the ocean was above me and the sky was below me, and this was a really, you know, odd thing. And then a few seconds later I kind of shook my head and I realized what had happened was, when I blacked out, I fell, obviously, and should have fallen into the water and been run over by the boat, which would have been pretty bad news. But in fact, what happened was my feet got tangled up in the lines that were attaching the lifelines to the deck. That is, the missing bow pulpit required these lifelines to be tied off up at the bow, so they were cleated off on some of the mooring cleats at the bow there, and there was this, you know, these lines down there by my feet. Well, as I fell, my feet got tangled up in them, so even though I was unconscious, I ended up basically suspended, hanging from the bow of the boat with my head down over the side of the boat. And so it was a extremely fortunate event in that sense. And the interesting thing, too, is that nobody at the back of the boat actually even saw this happen. You know, all their attention was on gathering the sail in. One person, the other half of my foredeck team, George Keane, a great guy, and proved to be a great guy on this occasion, as on many others, did see it and came running forward. And, you know, the thing I remember is the look of concern on his face and his hesitation. He didn't, as he described it later, you know, he could see that I was hanging there and that there wasn't a whole lot between me and falling into the water. I mean, I was over the side of the boat. And he said that, you know, it didn't look, you know, with the whole thing with my feet being tangled up, it didn't look real secure. He was really hesitant to actually touch me because he was afraid that if he did anything, it was going to cause me to come free and fall into the water. But that did not happen. He reached down and grabbed my hand and pulled me back on board, and we got the sail back on the, you know, we got the sail lowered, and I was none the worse for wear except for a bump on the head. But You'd think I would have learned from that, that, you know, anticipating, oh, I can do a 3-hour commute every day. I can give up posting on lies.com. Anticipating that intellectually is not the same as experiencing it emotionally. So having now experienced it, I have a better appreciation of what it means to give up my daily posting fix on lies.com. The way it really manifests is I see these stories and I think, man, that would be a great story for lies.com, and I just don't have the time to put it on there. And I think what I need to train myself to do is whenever I have that feeling, just get it on there anyway. Do something quick, even if I don't have time to go into some obsessive discussion of how I feel about the issue or what sort of nuance about it I want to comment on. I can at least get a pointer there to the item, and it'll be there as part of the lies.com record. You know, again, here we are with my grandiose sense of what it is I'm actually doing on lies.com. Some sort of journal of record for high-profile falsehood in American political and social life. The story that I'm really thinking of when I talk about having that sort of regret that's been most prominent in my mind lately is the one about, I can't remember the name of the judge now. I think it's John Jones III, something like that. Anyway, the judge in this Dover, Pennsylvania school board case regarding inserting language about intelligent design into school science curricula. And it turned out to be kind of a moot point in the legal sense, because the school board that passed this really ridiculous resolution about inserting intelligent design into the science curriculum in the Dover, Pennsylvania school system, that school board was basically, you know, ridden out of office on a rail and replaced with people who opposed that action by the time this decision came out from the judge. But still, the judge's decision was a really wonderful piece of work. The language in there just cried out to me for quoting on lies. And I'll get to that. Hopefully I'll have time to do that this weekend. But I think that my favorite part was where he talked about the breathtaking inanity of the Dover School Board. That sort of speaking that kind of truth, giving a higher profile to that kind of truth, is really the sort of unsung flip side to what I try to do with lies.com. You know, the original motivation setting it up was only half that I wanted to have a place to profile what I saw to be important lies, important falsehoods by public figures and what have you. The other side was that I also really wanted, and this I think was more a factor in my founding the site, in that sort of obsessive enthusiasm I felt when I first set it up, it was more to have a high-profile case to speak the truth and to highlight the truth when spoken by others, to publish truths that, for whatever reason, would not normally be communicated in a high-profile way. So this some of the language in the judge's decision in that Dover School Board case definitely qualified as speaking truth in this case about the whole intelligent design debate. And I love the fact that the passage where he talked about how he would be characterized as an activist judge, and he sort of preemptively tore that argument to shreds. That he was not the judicial activist here. The activists were the people on the school board who passed these passed this resolution without really considering the specifics of what they were teaching in the school, or without really giving a good hearing to the merits of the position that they were advocating for. So anyway, I wish I had had more time to talk about that. Judges in general are, the judiciary in general is, I think, one of the few signs of hope lately, and it's, I think, really doing what the founding fathers of the United States intended for it to do. That, you know, the judiciary in a real sense was meant as the sort of last defense against tyranny, that, you know, Congress and the presidency were always going to be susceptible to takeover by tyrants, by people whose own interests ran counter to those of the nation, and that you really needed those judges in place and kind of being the referees, you know, the protest committee, if you will, of the nation's disputes to just have some sense of reality dictating, you know, some sort of wise judgment dictating the course of the nation when the president and the Congress had failed to live up to their responsibilities, which I think is certainly the case in the last 5 or 6 years, that the president and Congress have failed to live up to their responsibilities. Although there was some good news out of the Senate in the last few days. I see that Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, who thought he had finally managed to get that North Slope drilling, that Arctic National Wildlife Refuge oil drilling package, he attached it to a defense appropriations bill, thinking, aha, I've got them now. You know, they won't be able to remove that. And, you know, the holidays are coming. The Senate wants to go home. But no, what didn't happen, the Senate stripped the bill of that item. So not this time for the Arctic drilling, of which I'm very happy. What was the other thing? There was nothing in the paper today that made me feel pretty pleased. Well, lately, feel pretty pleased with that. Oh, right, the voting for the extension of the Patriot Act, which is one of those weird cases where, you know, I'm cheering the extension of something that I think is deeply flawed. Of course, I'm cheering it because the White House and Bill Frist had been playing this game of chicken with the Senate Democrats, where they were basically saying, okay, you know, you don't like the Patriot Act, you want to remove these provisions of it that are not needed and are a violation of our civil rights. We're not going to do that. You have to either renew this act, you have to either make this act permanent as is, you know, with all its current provisions. You have to say, yes, give us the Patriot Act, or no Patriot Act at all. We're going to, you know, maneuver to make it so that there will be the Patriot Act will expire, and the president will be left helpless in the face of the terrorists, and the president will go to the people and show them that Congress has jeopardized their safety. Well, it was a bogus argument. You know, it was transparent, certainly for a person like me who at this point gives Bush no real credibility and is willing to believe any sort of nefarious interpretation of his actions. But it seemed very clear. Yeah, they were playing politics. The White House was playing politics, and you know, the Senate wanted to. Majority of the Senate was basically arguing, look, we need additional time to debate these compromises on the Patriot Act, these issues that, you know, things we want to remove from it, things that it doesn't need. And the White House wasn't willing to do that. Although, again, with this whole thing with the FISA courts and Bush authorizing warrantless wiretaps going around the FISA courts, it's hard for me to see what the big deal is about the Patriot Act, as several people have commented, including several senators. That, you know, Bush is willing to go around the law anyway and just do what he wants and feels that that's justified, then why are we even having this debate? We don't need the Patriot Act. We don't need any laws. We have Bush. You know, he can decide what's right and wrong. Anyway, so yay for the Senate. I'm not sure that I give them credit for actually having backbone and living up to their constitutional responsibilities out of a deep-rooted love of the Republic. I think it's just that, you know, Bush politically is becoming weaker by the day, and they're looking forward to 2006, and they're thinking in terms of, you know, their own political future, which is how you have to think if you're going to become a senator. But in any event, I'm happy with what they did there. A small victory. So now that I've managed to work my way around to the obligatory Bush-bashing part of my podcast, there is one thing I was thinking about that... Why did I think of this? Oh, I was reading First Draft, the First Draft weblog, which I heartily encourage you to go read if you don't read it regularly. Not reading the First Draft weblog on a regular basis is one of the things I regret about my new job situation, not having the time to properly indulge in it. But if you go read that, you know, my favorite part there is Holden's obsession with the gaggle. And of course, it's based on the daily press briefings that Scott McClellan has with the White House press corps. And it centers on this idea that these press briefings are not really meant for conveying information, because really except for little trivial bits here and there, it really doesn't serve that purpose. If you watch them, you realize that it's theater. It's a chance for the press to ask questions that they would like answered, and for McClellan to, you know, give 1,000 variations on no comment, or where he says no comment without appearing to say no comment, or where he denies without actually denying, or where he gets a chance to repeat the White House talking points of the day in 17 different versions that, you know, don't sound exactly the same, but gosh, they come close. But it is sometimes interesting, and certainly when there's a big story like the one about Bush's illegal wiretaps that came out recently, it's fun. It's a chance to kind of see this theater, this fun interaction. You can watch the video on the White House website. It's really one of the neatest things, I think, about the White House website. You know, even when it's not going well for them, they do put that video up there, and you do get the chance to see it. I have to make a side comment now. I'm on my commute. I'm now approaching the point where PCH passes Magoo Rock. So I'm going through, I've passed Oxnard, and I'm just about to hit the point where they make all those car commercials. I mean, literally, I see them making a commercial there every, well, at least once every couple of weeks. But it's that windy part of PCH, you know, right by the ocean. And as I'm approaching there, there's this amazing transition where you go past Magoo Rock. You know, right now I'm north of the Santa Monica Mountains, but in about a minute I'm going to be south of it. And today, and there's amazing weather there. You see these really awesome winds sometimes, these incredible willowaws that come blasting off the mountains and you know, make these huge bursts of spray and head out to sea. What I'm seeing now is I'm actually just now entering a fog bank. I guess there's fog south of Magoo Rock, and I've just entered it. It's really a cool sort of meteorological phenomenon to see this bank lurking there, to be in bright sunlight, and then realize in just a few seconds you're going to be inside a cloud, which is where I am now. Anyway, returning to the matter at hand. Yes, press briefings and theater and McClellan. Since it's theater, and since this podcasting thing is all about indulging my own sense of my own importance and my own power, my own ability to imagine things into existence, I want to share with you a fantasy I have. And this fantasy is about, sometime in January 2009, when Bush's successor will have taken office, and hopefully it's someone I can be happy with. You know, my list of people I'd be happy with is growing by the day. I was talking on Lies not that long ago about, you know, one of the effects on me of the Bush presidency is that it's greatly increased the list of people that I would accept as improvements in the White House. But since it's my fantasy, I'll make it someone really fun like Al Gore or who else? I guess Hillary, just to drive the wing nuts crazy. Barack Obama. There we go. President Obama. So it's late January 2009, and President Obama is holding his first press conference. And he walks into the room, and reporters all get to their feet and applaud him. And breaking with tradition, he doesn't stride right to the podium. No, he walks out and he greets the reporters. He's greeting them by names. And of course, many of them he knows from the campaign trail. And he's shaking hands and he's working the room. And he works his way towards the back of the room and has a special greeting, a warm embrace for Helen Thomas. Takes her arm and leads her down the aisle as the applause continues. And goes to the chair front and center in the first row that's had a reserved sign on it, removes the sign and graciously bows to her, saying, "Ms. Thomas, I believe this is your chair." The throng of press people goes wild, and we fade out on my fantasy for January 2009. I was thinking about that because of in a recent Holden's Obsession with the Gaggle, there was a discussion of Helen Thomas. Lately, Helen will get into it with Scott McClellan sometimes during the press briefings, and it's, you know, it's both entertaining and kind of heartbreaking, too. There's an honesty in, you know, Helen Thomas was an opponent of invading Iraq, as I was, as a lot of people were. And I think she takes seriously that when she's in those briefings, she's not there to advance the White House's talking points. She's there to represent her readers, and she's there to represent people with reasonable differences with the administration, and she gets into it with Scotty. She'll ask him these questions about the dead in Iraq, about the civilian death toll, and, you know, he'll give his spin, but if you think of it as sort of this cage match of competing ideas up there as she's asking her questions and he's making his responses, for me, I don't think he wins that exchange. I think his responses sound hollow. And sometimes her question sounds really heartbreaking. Anyway, I won't think about the heartbreaking part. I'll think about my happy fantasy of Helen Thomas restored to her rightful position in the front row at the White House press events. I've now come free of that little patch of fog. The fog's still out there, but it looks like it's about a half mile offshore now as I head south of Magoo Rock. Big surf today. I found this yesterday was sort of the downside of my sneaky route into work, was that yesterday around 9 o'clock I was going through the part of Malibu, like Sunset and PCH, the part of Malibu close to Santa Monica, and there was stop-and-go traffic basically from all the surfers, because there's really big surf right now from a storm off the coast. And most of them weren't actually even surfing. They were watching the few real brave ones who were out there in the big waves. And there's big surf again today, so I don't doubt I'll have a nice long delay once I get down there. But it is amazing the view you get traveling along the coast when there's a big, when there's big surf like this, because sometimes those waves coming in and going out, they meet and you get this huge explosion of white water. At high tide, I've actually had times when, there was water coming across PCH. I haven't seen any of that in the last couple days of commutes, but maybe the tide just hasn't been quite right. In any event, I'm going to wrap up this podcast before I divert into even more breathtaking inanity. But I want to thank all of you who listen, and thank all of you who've sent in emails and comments telling me that you like the podcast. I'm glad you like it, and it doesn't take many of those to motivate me to keep going, since I multiply them many thousandfold in my fevered brain as I imagine the throngs who are just hanging on my every word. This copyrighted podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons license. Please see my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I am John Callender, and thank you once again for listening.